Faith is not gullibility. I'm afraid one does have to tackle this. The amount of people we've come across who want to take things on faith when it's not biblical faith, it's gullibility and presumption. So tonight, let's consider how Christians cooperate in their own demise. Do you know how many Christians vote for parties that are pro-abortion, pro-homosexuality, pro-gay agenda, who hate them, who would even like to steal their land and see them murdered? And yet the Christians vote for them. It's just extraordinary. My youngest son, Calvin, mentioned a girl he knows from school who went to a Christian school and said, no, she's voting for the EFF. Now, this is a white Pinelander voting for the EFF. Why? Oh, well, I just wanted to vote against the whites because, you know, of all the privilege and this and the other. And he's asking, well, what white privilege? What are you talking about? This person's been so brainwashed in a Christian school. But it's not just by voting how people meant to do this. You just think of the vast amount of Christians today who think that all you need to do is blow a shofar on the beach and you're going to solve all the problems. There's a lot of Christians into an idea of it's more like agricadabra. So basically, okay, we can ignore God's commands, neglect his word, fail to apply his word day in, day out, year after year, send our children to be brainwashed in the indoctrination gulags of the secular humanists. We can vote for parties that hate God. We can be involved in all sorts of dumb things that are actually destroying our lives. But then along comes Mary Poppins and everything just goes back into order, or you agricadabra, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, let's all sing kumbaya and sway together and everything's going to be solved. But what have we learned? We can't expect God to solve the problems with just a rally, a prayer meeting, waving some flags and blowing a shofar. Many people have bought into the lie, and there's a lot of lies. It's evolutionism, it's situation ethics, there's a whole range of things that there's a lot of lies. And participate in the slandering of those who question the many lies, the New World Order, and its anti-Christian agenda. I've come across Christians wearing Vladimir Lenin t-shirts, Che Guevara t-shirts. Why would you want to associate with Antichrist pagans? Just take a man like Vladimir Lenin, who was a Satanist who hated Christ, who murdered millions of Christians, who said that we wage war against God to snatch believers from God and to bring God down from heaven. The hatred that these people have for God. You take a man like Che Guevara. Many Christians wear his t-shirt. Che Guevara said, if Jesus Christ came back to the world today, I'd squash him like a bug. Well, Jesus Christ is around, and right now I think he's squashing Che Guevara like a bug. Che Guevara is not just blasphemous, he is stupid. To try and take on the God of the universe, nobody beats the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The trouble is we've got a lot of Christians participating in a lot of the lies of the New World Order and anti-Christian agenda. For example, supporting theistic evolution, the myth of overpopulation, global warming, the government must, let's get our kids all vaccinated. You know, just think of the logic of this, that if you want to fight pornography, what's the best way to fight pornography? Give your son softcore pornography. That makes sense? Well, that's what vaccination is. Give a person some of the disease to protect them from the disease. This doesn't make sense on any level, but when you do any investigations, you find the people promoting it are the people like Bill Gates who would like to get the population world down to 100 million. But we've got 7 billion. So is this to extend people's life expectancy or is this to reduce life expectancy on Earth? When you look at what's going on and how many aborted babies are used for these vaccines and all the different things involved, you'd question it. But there's a lot of anti-Christian agenda out there on so many different levels. We've just gone through all the propaganda campaigns. We know that politicians lie, and we know that they can't spell, and they can't proofread, and they can't even see which way they go. But do you know the Christians in Cape Town who voted for this XPAC, this Cruella de Vil, we know as Patricia de Lille, she was PAC in 1993 when the St. James Massacre took place. She supported them. I saw her march with the PAC in 1993 past the St. James Church in Kenilworth down to the Lansdowne Claremont Police Station to demand the release of Micaiah McCormack, the terrorist who has machine gunned the people in the church, the one who got wounded by Charles when he shot back, and to demand him leaving. Now, I walked the whole length hearing her and others chant, "One church, one bomb, one minister, one bullet." One church, one bomb, one minister, one bullet. Of course, one settler, one bullet, and kill a Boer, kill a farmer. But the one church, one bomb, one minister, one bullet. She was in the front row chanting with them. Well, then she became an independent Democrat. And then she became DA. What Helen Ziller was thinking of, who knows. But, I mean, these three are all out. They've all fallen out. Not one of them's in the DA anymore in leadership. So, interesting. The DA has really fallen apart. And now she's got the good for nothing party. And, in fact, if you see how quickly the paint has faded, the ink from the posters on the... In fact, they were up there just a few days and it was really fading. So, didn't have good printers, doesn't have good policies. Auntie Pat, I ask you. I mean, and yet there are people who fall for this. How many times can... This person is a political prostitute. When you can go from PAC to ID to DA to good for nothing, what on earth? What are Christians doing falling for this when these people keep coming out with, what does this person stand for if they can go from PAC to DA? Socialism is a lazy man's ideology, says Joseph Sowell. To win votes, to gain political power, it takes no skill to promise people free stuff. You can give people something for nothing, no problem. Building wealth and creating employment is obviously much harder to achieve, which is why it's the route avoided by the most corrupt and incompetent regimes. Corrupt and incompetent politicians don't choose the route of hard work and ingenuity and self-sacrifice. They're going to choose the way of free. You get people who work for a living, and then you get people who vote for a living. And sadly, we've got the characters who just want to vote for a living and not work for a living, get free stuff. They outnumber the people who try to work for a living. And this is one reason why you've got parties like the DANC, EFF, and so on. Ayn Rand said, there's no difference between communism and socialism, except in the means of achieving the same ultimate end. Communism proposes to enslave men by force. Socialism, by vote. It is merely the difference between murder and suicide. And the term in Afrikaans, self-moord, is the correct term for suicide. It is self-murder. Socialism is anti-Christian. And yet the amount of criticisms we received in Africa Christian Action for the Biblical Issues Voters Guides, because we put down for some parties socialist instead of free enterprise. And how can you say this? Well, because you advocate state control of everything and heavy taxes and free this, that, and the other. And well, isn't that Christian? No, it isn't. Let's just take things like thou shalt not steal. And thou shalt not covet the neighbor's goods. I mean, there's two good economic principles written into Ten Commands. Thou shalt not covet the neighbor's goods, not even the oxen that pulls the plow, the means of production, equivalent of tractor today. You're not to covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. Private enterprise is written into the Ten Commands and into the parables of our Lord Jesus. From the Sermon on the Mount through all of his parables, the Lord basically spoke of money always in a free market system, not in a socialist system. And so socialism is communism by the vote. Because remember, what's the Soviet Union called? The Union of Soviets? Socialist republics, yeah. The communists say socialism is the road to communism. And now we've got a whole bunch of Christian socialists, which is just another way of saying God-fearing atheist or oxymoron. Alex de Tocqueville said a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote for themselves, largesse, from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, meaning financial policy, always followed by dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations have been about 200 years. That was a Frenchman writing in 1830 after visiting America. He wrote Democracy in America. And he obviously observed things quite effectively. Now, this is what happens when you hand out contracts to civil engineers who don't know much about what they're doing. You know, the whole purpose of the drain is to drain the water. When the drain's higher than the rest of the place, and it doesn't drain. Now, I'm not an engineer, but I'm just picking up that he missed a few steps here. And then you get, of course, we've had all these electric, or quite aside from it being illegal to put a poster on a road sign. So we had all these choices. And right now they're busy counting manually. There's a lot of room for human error, even malice and cheating if you want. But the IEC, which is the ANC-appointed Independent Electoral Commission, has been patting themselves on the back on what a phenomenally great job they've done. Now, they've admitted that many of the stations weren't open at 7 when they meant to, but they said most stations were open by 11 a.m. Now, they all were meant to be open at 7. They're patting themselves on the back that most were open by 11 a.m., others by 11:30. And only 5 stations hadn't opened yet by 5 p.m. And I think this is great. And they're trumpeting themselves as though they're always issuing press statements, praising themselves. The IEC must read that passage in the Bible that says, let the mouth of another praise you, not your own mouth. We should never be praising ourselves. But this is what politicians and governments and the IEC do. They endlessly, oh, we did such a good job. Okay, we ran out of ballots in many of the places. We ran out of ink in many of the places. A lot of the indelible ink disappeared very quickly. But, you know, we did a great job. Something like 16 voting stations blew away. Temporary voting stations, I presume they were tents. And there were 30 that were closed down because of rains. And then there were a whole lot of power failures throughout KwaZulu and Johannesburg area and Mpumalanga and Limpopo. But yes, there were cases of people voting twice, 3 and 4 times that have been proven. But the IC says they did a wonderful job and the integrity of the democratic process cannot be questioned. Well, any one of those things would have been a disgrace, I would have thought. But they don't seem to be ashamed of the fact that they can run out of ballots and have power failures the moment you start to come to count, which is becoming a joke now. They always have power failures when you start to count. And this is a mess, as far as I can tell. Anyone recognize this character? Rolf Meyer. He was once South Africa's Minister of Defense. We called him a canary. He was the creep that FW put in to replace Magnus Malan, who was a general. And he, who had been a corporal in the army, became Minister of Defense. And all he had done in the army was sing. I think he's part of the choir. So he is called the canary. I met him when he is the Minister of Constitutional Development, and he was the General Secretary of the South African, of the National Party in South Africa. He was the key negotiator for the National Party, and his opposite number was Cyril Ramaphosa, who is the main negotiator for the ANC. He now puts his face on posters, I vote ANC. Now, did anyone notice that Pitbuerter, who was our Minister of Foreign Affairs at the time, also crossed the floor and joined the ANC shortly afterwards? So just to remind you that the National Party was hijacked by Volksverraaiers, absolute traitors, backstabbers, who probably had a hand in trying to kill P.W. Botha with that so-called stroke, which was definitely poison. And this Rolf Meyer, by the way, let me just say a few words about this Rolf Meyer, because he's a Reformed Church member. And he hired witch doctors. As he was the General Secretary of the National Party, he hired witch doctors to design a new corporate image for the National Party, and it came out with a scrambled eggs thing. And he then hired witch doctors to dedicate the National Party offices in Soweto before the 94 elections. And they sacrificed a goat and they sprinkled the entrails and blood of the goat over him. I thought, serves him right. How did this man not get excommunicated from his church? Meant to be a member of a Reformed Church, and he's hiring witch doctors to put a curse on the enemies and to bless them, and having sacrificed goats entrails over him, over his neck, like he's just gone to Hawaii and he's being welcomed with a garland of flowers or something. I met this character at one time with a delegation from United Christian Action, which is what the Christian Action Network was called back then. And the senior leader at the time, Ed Cain was speaking. Ed Cain is a senior man. Ed Cain is double my age at that stage. He is in his 60s. And this Rolf Meyer is my age, I think. Might be a little younger. But this Rolf Meyer was walking up and down in a suit just outside the city hall in Pretoria. And Ed Cain, politely as Ed Cain always was, objectively was giving the facts. And he hadn't gone but a couple of paragraphs when Rolf Meyer turned around and said, "You're the problem. It's you, right-wing extremist. You're the problem. There's no problem from the left. There's no threat from the communists. It's you. It's you, right-wing extremist." At this point, I said, "Excuse me, Mr. Meyer, there's no need for you to talk to Ed Cain like that." And he turned around, "And I know all about you, Peter Hammond. I know about you. I know about you." Now, this is the man who's general secretary of the Southern Communists, of the national body. Well, now he's come out. At the time, I thought, is the National Party stupid? Now I discover they weren't stupid at all. They had been hijacked by people on the other side. You don't just move from being a nationalist to being a communist like that. He was a traitor at the time, or he couldn't make the stand now. How else do you put it? And at the time, I remember warning people who loved leaders in the National Party, and my grandfather was a cabinet minister in the National Party. My husband was a cabinet minister. My father's a cabinet minister in the National Party. This is the party of my great-grandparents. I've got to vote National Party. I said, but the National Party's changed. National Party's been hijacked. They're no longer the party of General James Barry Hertzog. It's a different group. I mean, these are the people who stabbed P.W. Botha in the back when he was president. If they didn't, and at the time I remember thinking, if they couldn't respect the president, like P.W. Botha, who was the leader of their party as well, after all he had done, what respect do you think they've got for you and I, the voters? Nothing. They despised us. Well, I discovered very quickly he despised me. But to think he has put his name out there, by the way, you can Google it, he endorses expropriation without compensation as advocated by his friend Cyril Ramaphosa, and he trusts Cyril and he's sure that this policy is going to be for the best. This is the chief National Party negotiator who negotiated for us the tremendous deal we've got right now. When we had the superpower of Africa, we could have negotiated anything we wanted, actually. Romans 16 verse 18 says, "By smooth words and flattering speech, deceive the hearts of the simple." Now, we have got Cyril the squirrel. Boy, does he have smooth speech. And can he have a flattering tongue? And can he smear honey all around your mouth? The price of apathy towards public affairs is to be ruled by evil men, said Plato 2,400 years ago. Now, we've got a lot of people who say, "I'm not interested in politics." But politics is very interested in you. It wants your money, it wants your taxes, it wants your children, it wants your allegiance, it wants your cooperation, it wants all sorts of things from you, conformity, you name it, and often your silence and complicity in their crimes. Socialist Democrats say you cannot give a lethal injection to serial killers, pedophiles, rapists, and school shooters. Now, this is from America, where in many places they don't execute you by electric chairs, they used to, or by gallows or firing squad in Utah, for example, but in many parts of America, like I think Texas, they execute by a lethal injection. So you can't give a lethal injection to murderers and serial killers and rapists, but you can give a lethal injection to a baby in the womb. Think about that mentality. We've got people in this country who say you cannot execute murderers and rapists because we have a right to life clause in the Constitution. But that right to life doesn't apply to babies. They don't have a right to life. You can kill babies. You just can't kill murderers. Does this make any sense to anybody? This is why many people say that liberalism is actually it's a mental disease. Prayer is not a substitute for biblical action. And this is deeply disturbing. We've got a lot of Christians today. Let's face it, prayer is not that popular. But you can get a lot more people to a prayer meeting than you can to an evangelistic outreach. And you can get a lot more people to an evangelistic outreach and to a mission into a restricted access area in a war zone across the border. So as the cost of commitment increases, the numbers decrease. Fair enough. But most people don't want to pray, for sure. But you'll still get more people to a prayer meeting than you'll get to evangelism, because that's tougher. It's more demanding. Now, a lot of people think that prayer is the answer to everything, but it isn't. Just take in Judges 7, the first defeat of the children of Israel, Battle of Ai. Joshua is in the tabernacle, lying down in front of the altar of the Lord, face down the ground in prayer. And God comes to him and says, Joshua, what are you doing lying down there on your face? Get up. There's sin in the camp. There's a time to pray and there's a time to act. Prayer is not a substitute for obedience, for biblical obedience. All too often you come across the attitude of all we can do is pray. That's not true. We've got a whole Bible there. When you put just in front of things, you devalue it. So when you say, I just want to thank you for dying for my sins. I just want to pray for this and I just want to pray for that. Lord, just, the Bible says the prayer of a just man is powerful, but it's not meaning putting the word just in front of things. Because when you put just in front of any biblical command or any prayer, you're devaluing everything else. It's always more than that. You know, you get these people who want to simplify things, say, you know, the whole problem is, and then they will put whatever they think it is. Well, it might be part of the problem, but it's always more than that. Because there's sin, there's selfishness, there's prayerlessness, there's neglect of the word of God, there's cowardice. There's a whole range of things that affect us. And for you to say, you know, the whole problem is, whatever you mention may be valid, but it's not going to be the whole thing. It's only going to be part of a complex picture. We can all do much, much more than pray after we've prayed. But prayer is not meant to be an excuse for disobedience or an alternative to obedience. Prayer is meant to be a foundation, a first step for obedient action. All that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. And I'm afraid right now we've got theater too, where some people think, just take for example, we had an important planning meeting with some important people here last Thursday afternoon. And one of the men stood up and he said, you know, we've had these transformation prayer meetings. We've filled stadiums. We've had more prayer meetings. We had 1 million people at Bloemfontein praying. Why is it that everything's getting worse? Well, that's not anything any Christian wants to hear, because we all know that there's power in prayer and we know that God answers prayer. And we know that prayer is part of the solution that we need to be seeking. But they're dead right, and this does need to be addressed. We've had so many prayer movements. Why is it that things have gotten worse? Well, you could argue things would have gotten a lot worse and they've slowed it down. And I think there's a certain element of the fact that so many Christians in this country are sincere and so many have prayed. God has been gracious and merciful, and we can all say things could be a lot worse, and praise God that things are only as bad as they are and not as bad as we deserve them to be. That's valid. But surely this isn't good enough, because, in fact, Anthony was just saying it over tea beforehand tonight, that if you think of the amount of people who have gone to Mighty Men's conferences, to these big prayer meetings, easily you could calculate 3 million people. Now imagine if those 3 million people had been encouraged, never waste your vote on an anti-Christian party, on a secular humanist party, on a pro-abortion, pro-perversion, pro-secular humanism, pro-pornography party. Imagine if at those Mighty Men's conferences it was made clear you cannot waste your vote on a party that does not stand for the right to life of preborn babies. I mean, just for one example. Imagine what a difference that could have made. We have a miniature fraction of the Bible-believing, born-again, church-going people in this country voting for parties that are pro-life. The vast majority of people who claim to be Christians in this country are voting for parties like the DA and CEFF, who are pagan. And you can't just think, well, they're not the real Christians, because how many times do you come across people saying, well, in my Bible study, I've got this person who's an EFF supporter and this. And we all know mountains of Christians are DA supporters. Lots. They're all around us. And they're in our families. And how do they justify this? Well, they do all kinds of convoluted mental and ethical gymnastics to justify why they're doing it, because lesser of two evils and all the rest of it. And that, well, you know, you can't waste your vote in a small party. So, we vote for the bigger party because they've got a chance to keep the ANC out. But we've got a proportional representation system. No vote is wasted. Every single vote will go to the party that you support, and they can form a coalition with other parties to keep the ANC, the EFF, or whatever you want out, if that is how we can support it. The only way your vote's going to be wasted is if you vote for a secular humanist party. And to be honest, what's the difference between the DA and the ANC? They're both secular humanists. They're both pro-perversion. They're both pro-pornography and homosexuality and all the rest of it. Yes, the one is not quite as socialist as the other, but they're both socialist even. They're humanist. And while you could argue that the DA is better than the ANC, well, by degrees, but they are going in the same direction. They don't want communism. They just want socialism. They prefer suicide to murder. They prefer to progress the socialist agenda by the votes instead of by revolution. We as Christians can do better than that. And in this country, we've got alternatives. We just had, how many alternatives were there? 40? Unbelievable. 7 Christian parties, as far as I could tell, on the ballot. Some of which totally socialist, sad to say. Many of them don't understand the first thing about biblical economics. But remember, all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. Now, have you heard people say, that's not my job? This is a story about 4 people named Everybody, Somebody, Anybody, and Nobody. There was an important job to do, and everyone was sure that somebody would do it. Anybody could have done it, but nobody did it. Somebody got angry about that because it was everybody's job. Everybody thought anybody could do it, but nobody realized that everybody wouldn't do it. It ended up that everybody blamed somebody when nobody did what anybody could have done. That's the story of 4 people. Isn't that the way it often goes? You get these people coming, why doesn't somebody do something about this? But what you could ask is, what can I do about this? That's the more Christian response. We are commanded to be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Doers of the word, putting feet to our faith. We've got to sometimes get onto the streets. Now, there's a individual up in Transvaal that I met at the Kruikduck, and he asked permission to take our voters' guides and to put them on lampposts. And he put them in newspapers like the Daily Sun with the voters' guide and the savotersguide.org website. And somebody else took our voters' guide and translated into this very colorful picture. Please do not kill me with your vote, indicating 2 pro-life parties and then a whole range of 6 abortion on demand parties. Now, that's a very good, striking image on social media. Somebody took our voters' guide and ran with it, checked with us ahead of time, and that's good. The only way you can justify murder is to hide the definition of life. They don't want to admit that life begins at conception, for example. Now, in our mission, we try to put feet to our faith. And one of the most remote, difficult, dangerous places in the world we've gone to is the Nub Mountains. And by God's grace, at this moment, we've got a team putting feet to the faith and doing something. John and Aubrey and Ben and Daniel are right now in the Nub Mountains. And these are just some pictures they've sent us. Isn't this extraordinary that through satellite, we can actually get pictures in the most remote area where we couldn't communicate before? And this is just part of the shipment of 40,000 Bibles, 50,000 Story of Jesus books, plus 2,000 Faith and Defiance Sedan books, 2,000 Chaplain's Handbooks, 2,000 Biblical Principles for Africa, 2,000 Greatest Century of Missions books, and then a whole lot of Arabic and Sunday school materials and notebooks, and just extraordinary. And they've already distributed most of them, over 25,000 Bibles. And they are equipping people all over the Nub Mountains. They've gone out in 4 teams and they've done their distributions. And here's Daniel ministering. It looks like a very Muslim orientated area here. How do you like the shell hung upside down? This is the school bell. People take a piece of shrapnel and whack it against the side of a shell for the school bell. And some of the children with the Story of Jesus books. Now, for many of these children, it's the first thing they will ever own. and certainly the first book in their homes. Story of Jesus for the Sunday schools, for the primary schools, and a New Testament, or full Bible actually for the higher education people for the high schools. And they've been doing leadership training, pastors training. They've just had a whole lot of chaplains trainings coming up. Before John head to the field, I interviewed him on our From the Frontline podcast on the visions and the goals. And of course, when they get back, we'll have them reporting back too. But they're still there, still need our prayers. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and not to do it, to him it is sin. We read in James 4:17. So during the election campaigning, we put out the savotersguide.org website and called people to reclaim our Christian heritage and demonstrate to the world that the Bible has the best answer to the world's most pressing problems. Do you know how much attacks we got for this? The amount of criticism. Because, oh, do you know some of the things we got? You mustn't be so judgmental. This isn't being judgmental. This is evaluating political parties on where they stand on 8 key issues. Why do you bring up the past? Well, how do you have a voter's guide if you don't evaluate by track record? Well, why don't you take our word for it? We said we're free enterprise. Yes, but you voted for every kind of socialist thing. Or you've got socialist campaigns everywhere in your manifesto. And no, now you're judging. Why is it that Christians can't tell the difference between evaluating and discerning and judging by fruits and track record? In the Soviet Union, they called it propaganda. In America and South Africa, they call it news. Wherever there's a big story in the media, look for the story they're trying to distract you from. There's always a more important story than what the media is focusing on. You just think what's happening to our country and the lead up to the elections, all the fires, which was overwhelmingly in the Western Cape. Why is it that the Western Cape was targeted for more fires, more burning of forests than anywhere else in the rest of the country? 75% of all the arson attacks in the Western Cape. We are not 75% the country's population or land surface. Well, it's because a bunch of Marxists have decided to target us in the Western Cape. Why? Because the ANC and the EFF want to get the Western Cape and loot it like they've looted the rest of the country. And so the most extraordinary amount of arson on trains, buses, churches, police stations, losing all the dockets, getting burned up, very convenient for those criminals. Why are churches being attacked? And all the, this is the kind of disruptions on the way to election. So when people say, oh, this is a peaceful election. No, it wasn't a peaceful election. In the months leading up to this, in the electioneering, there's been intimidation, there's been violence, there's been every kind of intimidation of the people who are going to be going to the polls. And we need to remind people, no matter who's present, Jesus Christ is king. He's not just king, he's king of kings, and he's lord of lords, and he's the conqueror, and he's coming again to judge the living and the dead. And they may think they get away with their cheating, but the day will come and everything will be made open. So I like to look at a couple of the blatant lies being told about South Africa's history, because the reason why so many people voted as they did is because they're believing lies. Vladimir Lenin said, a lie told often enough becomes the truth. And we've got everything from the Big Bang all the way through to toleration of sodomy and bestiality and pedophilia and abortion, atheism. All of these lies are told over and over and over until most people accept it. South Africa is a failed land of communist ANC and a place of white genocide and diaspora. About half of our population, I mean of white South Africans, is overseas now. Maybe half, maybe more than half, spread all over the world. Just like Zimbabwe. Half all Zimbabweans are outside the country. The uproar in South Africa over the land claims by the ANC is based on this. They claim that the 1913 Land Act, brought about under the British, by the way, dispossessed blacks, but it's a blatant lie. And it forms part of the four core lies about South African history. You see, it's the false narrative that's used to justify farm murders, expropriation without compensation, BBBEE, affirmative action, and all the rest, racial quotas. And these are some of the people propagating these core lies, which is a completely false narrative. And if you know our history, and if you read sketches from South African history, or come to the Reformation Society, or go through our videos and audios, you'll see why they're lies. And this is one of the lies. Notice the slogan of the ANC, a better life for all. What if you take the F out, because they are failed. They do get an F, they fail. It's a better? A better life for all. There's a common belief in South Africa that the Native Land Act of 1913 shoved blacks onto reserved, onto 7% of the land, and prohibited them from buying land in white areas. Well, actually, it prohibited whites from buying land in their areas, either for shops or farms or factories. But this is propagated again and again and again, over and over and over, until most people don't even question it. And this is why the EFF is getting the support they're getting, because they're building on the lie, which most whites don't even question, because most whites don't even know what the facts are either. That whites forcibly removed blacks to these reserves, and that these reserves are on the worst land in the country with no mineral riches, that whites kept all the best land minerals for themselves. I can tell you where this narrative comes from. United States and Canada, because that's what they did to their Indians. They chased their Indians off the best land, especially where there's minerals, and they basically pushed them into reserves. So because that's what the Americans and the Canadians did to their Indians, they assume that's what the whites must have done to the blacks in South Africa. Of course, that's total nonsense. It's not true. We didn't treat the black people of South Africa like the Australians treated the Aborigines, hunting them for sport and so on. We didn't force our black people into the worst areas possible when we controlled the country. Now, some might be tempted to believe this myth because it would ensure eternal victimhood status and compensation for generations to come. Free things for nothing. However, it's a blatant lie, and it can be attributed to the lack of reading ability or legal comprehension of numerous journalists and historians, I say in italics, of our time. First of all, the biggest platinum reserves in the world were run in the former black homeland of Maputo-Tswana, Northwest Province. The former nationalist government had no problem allocating this area to the Tswana tribe. Maputo-Tswana got its independence under P.W. Botha, his prime minister at the time. The Tswana people got self-rule over that, and they already had a massive country called Botswana, colossal country, which the Tswanas all come from. In fact, most of these are immigrants and migrant workers who came over from Botswana to South Africa for work. But they were given the land of Maputo-Tswana, which just happened to have the largest mine for platinum in the world. It was originally part of South Africa. Bechuanaland land was run as part of British South Africa. Blacks further got another two massive countries from the British called Lesotho and Swaziland, Basutoland and Swaziland. So these are three parts of South Africa, British South Africa, that were handed over to black rule already. So, well, there goes their so-called 7%. But here's a statistic, not even counting Botswana, Lesotho and Swaziland, but this from the Rural Development Land Reform, claiming that whites control 22% of South Africa. Now, what happened to the 78% and all the rest that they throw around? Well, they've got a different statistic there where they're actually talking about 78% of the best farmlands. Well, they weren't farmlands when the whites got there. They were actually thornbush and scrub like Olifantshoek, what today is Franschhoek. They didn't give farms to the French Huguenots in 1688. They sold them worthless piece of shrub. And they had to hack out of the wilderness the beautiful farms you see terraced over there now. So it's an absolute lie that the whites have most of the land. The southern government, sitting on over 4,000 farms, bought on a willing buyer, willing seller base, but they've never transferred them to white owners or black owners. So that's lie number one. Lie number two is black homelands were the worst land in South Africa. Now, I'm going to prove this to you with satellite photographs that that is a total lie. When you compare the rainfall map of South Africa, and anyone with elementary knowledge of South Africa will tell you that the largest part of South Africa is called the Karoo, which makes up most of the Cape, northern and western. Now, here's a satellite picture, and there you can see the Karoo. You've got the Groot Karoo, you've got the Klein Karoo, we down here in the Western Cape, and you can see how green everything is on the rest of the place. So, Otanequiland, tremendous rainfall on the coast. Klein Karoo, very dry. Central Karoo, drier. Main Karoo, seriously, seriously, seriously dry. You wouldn't want to have a farm over there. It's a semi-desert, comparable to Arizona or Nevada in the US. Blacks never even entered the land, let alone settled it. Whites made the Karoo blossom and created successful sheep farms producing meat of world quality, largely through these windmills and water pumps. But this is not friendly territory for farming. And no black pastoralist wanted to bring his cattle over here. In fact, they couldn't because the rainfall is under 300 milliliters a year in the western part of this country, which is where the Karoo is. Black settlements are found on the north and east coast of South Africa. And here you can see it's pretty green on the east coast. It's pretty brown on the west coast. You can draw a line through South Africa. And basically, west of that line, with the exception of the coastal area in the south where we are, is under 300 milliliters a year rainfall. Far too little for any kind of migrant farmer. This shows you even clearer where the green spots are and where the brown spots are. And you can see that the best farms are in Transkei and KwaZulu and Mpumalanga and up in Limpopo, in fact. The east coast has a subtropical climate and the north a prairie-like climate with a summer rainfall and thunderstorms. An exception to this is the Western Cape where we live with a Mediterranean climate and a winter rainfall. But even here, as you know, you've got to have serious amounts of boreholes and everything else to really survive because your growing season is, in the Cape, the dry season. We have winter rainfall, but the plants need to grow in summer, and they won't do that without irrigation. The northern and eastern parts of South Africa, with its beautiful green grasslands and fertile soil, is where the blacks eventually coalesced, and this is the land they chose for themselves. They weren't forced into Transkei and KwaZulu. That's where they settled. You can see the green areas are where KwaZulu and Transkei are. And the whites chose themselves some of the most arid spaces on the planet. You can also see by the habitation, just by lights from satellite from outer space at night, where the majority of the population are. Majority of the population are in the eastern part of the country and the northern part of the country, because the western part of the country, the Karoo, Northern Cape and Southern Cape, is not very habitable, actually. And most people choose not to live there, as you can see by the lights. Their eventual homelands were found on land they inhabited out of their own free will. Nobody forced them into it. Now, in America, they did take all the Indians after one scalping too many, and they forced all Indians to go west of the Mississippi River. And that was done under, was that President Jackson? They called it the Trail of Tears. And so that happened somewhere in the early 1800s. All Indians were forcibly removed from Western from Eastern America and had to go west of the Mississippi River. And that was because I think American settlers wanted to keep their scalps and they didn't like being attacked and have their homes burned while they were sleeping for some strange reason. So the Americans did force their Indians geographically out and forced them onto reserves. And when they found, whoops, there's some gold mine on there, moved them to another place. The Americans did that. South Africans did not. In fact, just look at Cape Town. And by the way, this satellite picture is quite disturbing because can you see how much charred forest we've got, burned areas? And I flew over this just recently, and it's shocking to see how much of our forest has been burned. Thousands of hectares of nature sanctuary, forestry have been burned by arsonists in the Western Cape in the last 3 years. It's seriously bad. You can see how little green we've got around here. We've got a little bit of green here and there in some of these mountains, but most of this is deforestation. And let me remind you that the Cape Flats used to have so many flays. They had flays. One flay was 20 kilometers wide. There were millions of geese and ducks on the Cape Flats. It was wetlands. We have drained wetlands, poured a whole lot of sand into the wetlands, and stuck homes in wetlands, and then we wonder why there's flooding in rainy season. The Cape has not been looked after the way it should have been by conservation-minded people, and the deforestation that's taken place in the last 25 years has been horrific. So this is another perspective of Cape Town. Remember, we're just like here. There's Devil's Peak, there's Table Mountain. So we're just behind that mountain there. Just to give you a bit of a feel of where we are. The Afrikaners even had a song praising the greenness of Natal called Groen is die land van Natal. Green is the land of Natal. It's a perfect grazing area for the cattle herding blacks. And that's why that's where the Zulus settled, mostly in that area, the very, very, very green part. And by the way, this just shows us again the four provinces of the Union of South Africa. The Cape, the woman with the anchor, Natal with the wildebeest, Orange Free State, and then the Ossewaar for the Transvaal. Here's line number three. Blacks indigenous to South Africa and blacks first settled South Africa. It's a major part of the false narrative. Today, blacks in South Africa often tell Afrikaners and other minorities like coloureds, Malays, Indians and Chinese to adapt to their misrule and corruption or go home. Go home? This is our home. Implying that we who've been born here, who hold legal citizenship through successive birthrights, that we should emigrate to Europe, Malaysia, India or elsewhere where most of us have never lived. Why should we leave our homes that we've built up here and hand over to a bunch of invaders who call us land thieves? That the only ones who have a legal claim to South Africa, all of South Africa, are the blacks. Blacks believe they're indigenous to South Africa, but they're not. It has been proven by DNA research we're all settlers in South Africa. All South Africans are settlers, regardless of their skin color, and the DNA carries the proof. So says Dr. Wilmot James, head of the African Genome Project. He's a distinguished academic, sociologist, and honorary professor of human genetics at the University of Cape Town. Where is the archaeological proof that blacks settled South Africa? Apart from a few scattered archaeological remains found of black culture in the far northern Transvaal prior to 1652, it's generally agreed blacks and whites both were contemporary settlers in South Africa, meaning black tribes, Bantu tribes, were moving into South Africa from the north as white settlers were arriving in the south. And we met roughly in the middle, about 1770, on the Fish River. We use the term settler loosely because blacks never actually settled South Africa. Their presence was nomadic. Blacks were itinerants who traveled from place to place with no fixed abode. Whole capital cities of grass huts, and this is one of the biggest of them, one of the most impressive of them, Ungungungluwu, which was Dingaan's kraal, or Dingaan's stut, as some call it, but Ungungungluwu is a Zulu name. And these are massive beehive huts, some of the biggest huts ever made, and some of them could have 30 poles inside to hold it up. They would relocate if grazing was exhausted. So when a Zulu king died, his capital was always burned and a new capital was established because they didn't have plumbing, electricity, things like that. And so the place had gotten overgrazed, and in fact, now there was a lot of diseases. To move to a new capital would be a fresh start for a new kingdom. And so they were continually moving. You can't go now and find the original Bulawayo capital of King Shaka, who founded the Zulu nation. They destroyed it when he died. I mean, that's the nomadic kind of existence they had. They had no demarcated areas, no fences, no borders, no maps, no title deeds to prove ownership of any land, just a verbal claim and a mutual understanding that their temporary presence in a certain area in a certain period of time constitute ownership of the land. They left behind no foundations of buildings, no statues, no roads, no rock paintings, not a single proof of settlement of the land prior to white settling in South Africa in 1652. The only rock paintings were made by the Bushmen and the Hottentots, who today we call Khoi Khoi and the San, in the caves they temporarily occupied. Now, this is interesting. You can see Khoi San rock paintings all the way up through Tanzania into Kenya. At one time, the Khoi and the San stretched all the way from Kenya down to the Cape. They got exterminated everywhere. As the Bantu moved in, they exterminated the Hottentots, the Khoi and the San, the Bushmen. They hunted them for sport or they enslaved them. And they exterminate them to such an extent that the only surviving Khoi San in the world today on the Western Cape and Namibia, Northern Cape, because that's where the whites protected them. And that's why when people like Thabo Mbeki came out with this nonsense that the Khoi and the San were black and they're always our brothers, and in every single battle, there were 11 battles, frontier wars, between the Khoza and the people of the Cape. In every one, the Khoi and the San identified with and allied themselves with the whites against the causer. Why? Their lives were at stake. They knew their only chance of survival was that the white settlers survived, because otherwise they wouldn't. That's why when we went up to the border in Southwest Africa, one of the units that were our allies was 201 Battalion, which then became 31 Battalion, Bushman's Battalion. One of my friends was an officer there. The Bushmen, 3,000 strong, joined the SADF. They were really good trackers, obviously. And boy, were they ferocious with the Vambos, because these little Bushmen had been hunted, enslaved, and abused for generations by the Vambo, and we had to hold them back because they would not take prisoners, actually, to be honest. So the white officers in the Bushman's Battalion had to interpose to save the lives of Swapo when these guys beat them. And just, if you didn't get there quick enough, there was no prisoner. The Bushmen always have identified with fighting for the whites, whether it was the Eastern Cape fighting against the Khoza or up in Angola fighting in the SADF and SWAT territorial force. So this false narrative of Thabo Mbeki that somehow the Khoisan and the black people are brothers is not the way they see it. The blacks were pastoral nomads, meaning goats and sheep. They were nomads, and the Bushmen, Hottentots, were hunter-gatherer nomads. So the Bushmen and the Hottentots left rock paintings behind, and so we know that they used to be all the way up to Kenya, and they've been exterminated since. And by the way, these are the sort of things you learn if you start walking around the Cape Flats and talking to people who coin-san about who's the original inhabitants and what they think about affirmative action and expropriation without compensation. These are some photographs taken by early, now we're talking about early 20th century or late 19th century, of the kind of habitations that black people had in, for example, what today is Limpopo, the Transvaal. This is what the Zulus were looking like, and this is the late 1800s now. And these are pictures taken in Rhodesia now. We're talking about Madibeeland in the late 1890s. And you can see the kind of warrior outfits and headdress and clothing, and you can see the knopkerrie and the spear. Again, some of the Rhodesian settlers coming, and the way the people were tied. Notice the interesting kind of head dress they wear. It looks like everything's been shaved with just a little bit of a mohawk. Again, you're getting an idea of the kind of clothing and the kind of implements that the people had, and hairstyles. This is definitely off the missionaries have arrived, because they've now got the woman dressed in some kind of clothes, because that was not normal beforehand. You get some very intriguing kinds of headdress. Now, this is in the Kafue River. So this would be northern Rhodesia, what today is Zambia. So I've ministered amongst these people too. And you can see people like this right now in Sudan, who still stretch their mouth out plates. White settlers, on the other hand, built cities and railroads and dams and a first world country comparable to all the best of Europe and the world. Their legacy speaks of a people intent to live here for 1,000 years. And you can see, like the Cape Town Parliament and, well, Cape Town City itself. Or anyone know where this city hall is? Durban. Pietermaritzburg. This is the Pietermaritzburg one. You can tell from the red bricks. And beautiful homes, and, well, I wouldn't call Johannesburg beautiful, but was impressive, considering there was nothing there 80 years before this picture was taken, and all built, well, on gold. And Pretoria. You go to place in Pretoria, and it's just astounding to think of the order and the neatness and the cleanliness and the magnificence of, like, union buildings. And this country is well built. Pretoria was one beautiful garden city at one time. And Union Buildings was totally open. I remember when I went to Pretoria, if I had a date, I always was for cheap dates because I was a missionary, I didn't have much money. We'd walk around in the gardens and go up to Union Buildings, and police would wander through now and then, but there was nothing stopping you. We'd sit there and look at the lights, and It was beautiful, just like you go up to Rhodes Mem any time. Now they lock these things at night. You can't even get to Union buildings, the main buildings up there during the day ever. I mean, when I've been there to try and show a foreigner Union buildings, and they said, suddenly they've got all these wrought iron gates and controls, and when can I go? Never, he says. I said, never? He says, yes, this is where the president's offices are. I said, they've always been the president's office since they built it in 1910. But we always had access before. What's changed? And, no, well, you know, it was then President Mbeki's time. He locked it off to everyone. This belongs to the people of South Africa. This doesn't belong to Thabo Mbeki. But now they've got it, and the gardens is what did. To claim that the whole of Africa belongs to blacks is absurd. It's like an Italian living in a boot here claiming that all of Europe, including Norway, belongs to him because, well, Italians are in Europe, so all of Europe belongs to Italians, right? How on earth can Bantu people who migrated down here claim to own all of Africa? The pyramids of Egypt are proof that white settlement goes back thousands of years in North Africa. The Phoenicians settled Carthage. The Greeks settled Alexandria. This is Africa. North Africa. This is 2,000 years ago. White Western civilizations built in Carthage. Magnificent city destroyed twice by the Romans because of their brutality and their hostility for the Christian white North African civilization of Carthage. Carthage must be destroyed was a theme resounding through in those days, just like South Africa and Rhodesia must be destroyed, resounded in my lifetime. The Arabs settled North Africa soon after the Prophet Muhammad died, and the whites settled Southern Africa from 1652 onwards. And so there were three Africas, as Dr. Eshel Rudy called it in his book, The Third Africa. Arabic Africa up north, Black Africa in the center, and White Africa in the south. There were three Africas. There's still Arabic Africa, there's still Black Africa. And now we are at the last little toehold at the end of Africa, the last surviving outpost of white civilization in Africa. Do we not have the right to be white Africans too? Look at the biblical history. The people, all the people of the world came from Noah's family, spread out from the mountains of Ararat, and you can see how the Ham and his descendants, Put and Nubia and Cush, they ended up in Africa, and Shem and Arabia, and you can see Japheth's descendants, mostly up in Europe and so on. And so these are some Bible maps showing how the spread of the nations from the time of Babel went throughout the world. But while you had Hamites moving into Africa, you still also had some Japhites and Shemites living in North Africa. In fact, the Egyptian kingdom, which was more European, was dominating North Africa, especially on the Nile, for a long time. But at one point, the Kushite Empire of Napata conquered Egypt. So at one time, Egypt, which was the superpower of the world, fell under African control through the Nubians, which today is Sudan. These are some of the imaginative maps that were made of Africa in the past. And you can see the Roman Empire stretched quite far down, almost to the cataracts where Nubia started. Now, over the years, Ethiopians started to expand into Central and West Africa. And then you could also see some of the Bantu tribes moving down from where Nigeria would be today across the Congo into East Africa, Central Africa, and then finally into Southern Africa. These are some of the civilizations, great African civilizations, Ethiopia being the longest running and the largest, going all the way back to probably the Queen of Sheba and so on. It used to be called Axum. Of course, there's the Nubian and the Kushite empires. You had the Bagundans, you had the Congo, and the Lunda and Luba kingdoms, Lozi, still very strong. And you had Monomotapa in what today is Zimbabwe. And all the way down, the most southern point was the Xhosa. They're part of the procession of the Bantu or the black races moving south. And again, you can see different African kingdoms going from before 200 years before Christ, which is the Kushites in particular, and Aksum are going all the way down to the Bantu migrations. And quite clearly, the whole of Central and Southern Africa was at one time empty, and it came to be populated as settlers moved further and further on. The idea that only whites were settlers because they came by boat, black settlers who came by land were not settlers, is not true to language. So again, you can see the different empires. And then the Portuguese started coming in 500 years ago, and the Tswana states were then, of course, in the very south, all you had was the San, the Khoi and the San. And they'd moved down to the south. So again, this is an idea of West Africa had greater civilizations built around Timbuktu, for example, the Malians and the Songhai, and of course the southernmost Zimbabwe or Monomotapan civilization. And these different maps show this. Africa got progressively settled, and there was 15th century kingdoms moving all the way down to 19th century kingdoms, and the Zulus celebrated just recently 200 years of their kingdom, and they're very proud of that. But somehow or another, we in the Cape, who've got almost 400 years heritage here, that means nothing. And someone arrived yesterday is called indigenous, and we called expatriates, and we might have been here for 12 generations. So in Zimbabwe, there was a kingdom, and the Shona are happy in their present textbooks to say that the Shona exterminated the original inhabitants of Zimbabwe when it came because they had superior weapons. That's in Mugabe's textbooks in his schools, that they claim that they don't claim to have been the original inhabitants. They claim to have killed the original inhabitants of Zimbabwe and taken over because they had better weapons. The Maori aren't the original inhabitants of New Zealand. The Maori ate the original inhabitants of New Zealand. The Indians in North America aren't the original inhabitants of North America. They killed the original inhabitants. The Indians in North America today, they came from Asia. They came during a time when you could cross over from the Alaskan waterways all the way down. And so this business of trying to suggest that just the white Europeans are invaders and have no right to live anywhere, it's ignoring all of history. And so we need to understand African history. And one of the things I'm working on is an African history book, a Christian history of Africa, which is so needed. Because unfortunately, it's false narratives that enable us to accept all these things. So here's how the colonials came in. And many people forget the fact that the colonials, in many cases, didn't come in to take land. Most of the colonial countries didn't want land. They just wanted trade. But in the trade, they discovered that many of the chiefs would not keep their side of the bargain. And so after a while, you found them coming in and taking a port, to take the port so that they could enforce treaties and obligations and repayment of loans and what have you. In North Africa, it was different. The Europeans started to take Algeria and Tripoli and the whole of North Africa because they were getting tired of all the slave raids that the Muslims were raiding into Europe and, in fact, enslaved 1.1 million white Europeans were captured by Barbary pirates in southern Europe and taken to build, in fact, virtually every palace, harbor, and major building work in the whole of North Africa has been built by white slaves from Europe, Christian slaves, who were kidnapped over the centuries from the 15th century to the 1800s. And only to stop those raids did Europe take North Africa step by step. They take the port, then they've got to take this next to it, and they've got to take the next. And in order to secure the southern part of Europe, they ended up taking the whole of North Africa. Now, most of Europe wasn't interested in Africa. And so you had, for example, the people in Southwest Africa. They went along, there were 11 tribes there, and they pleaded with the British, please make us a protectorate. We're being enslaved and butchered and genocided by the Avambos and the Damara. In fact, the Herero and the Damara were the two of the most aggressive of the tribes there. And so the others were pleading for the British to help them. The British weren't interested. They said, we overstretched. They just took Walfish Bay, the only decent ports on the whole coast, and they weren't interested in the rest of the country. The Rhenish missionaries pleaded with Bismarck, the Chancellor of Germany, who wasn't interested either. They went past him to Kaiser Wilhelm II, who was more compassionate, and he allocated a small group of troops to bring peace to Southwest Africa and to provide safety for the people. And the tribes cheered when Germany came and gave them a protectorate. The Lawsi in eastern Zambia pleaded with the British to make them a protectorate, the Lozi here, because they were afraid of the Portuguese coming and enslaving some of them. And the Portuguese were the only European country still doing slavery after the Napoleonic Wars. All of Europe abolished the slave trade in 1815, but not Portugal. Lozi requested British protectorate. The Lesotho requested a British protectorate. So did the Botswana. So did the Swazi. They requested it. The British didn't get a request from the Zulu. They invaded the Zulus. The Zulus never gave up their sovereignty. So you can see different areas like Sudan, they became a protectorate, the British. The Nigerians asked the British to come in to stop the slave raids of the Hausa and the Portuguese and the Arabs. And so the British made progressively more and more of what became Nigeria a protectorate. Some places were protectorates. Other places, they went for settling. Rhodesia was settled. Nyasaland or Malawi was a protectorate, and so on. But this is too complicated to the average person today. They just want to have bad colonials. Everyone came to colonize. Not so. There's many places that came only to protect them from slavery, to build them up with every intention of leaving quickly and giving them the independence. Like Sudan. As soon as the British thought they were ready, 1955, they handed over and they left. And they gave independence to many places where no British people were allowed to settle ever. They were only there to protect them from slavery and set them free. So it's a mixed bag. Africa is not one story. It's a complex, varied series of stories. Now here you can see the population density in the year 2000. You can see where most of the people live. Obviously, Nigeria and Ethiopia and around the Great Lakes is where most people live in Africa. It's quite a bit in the very, very, very north of Africa. And of course, Cairo and Alexandria is one big massive conglomeration. But you can see a lot of Africa is actually quite depopulated. Well, who wants to live in deserts? Similarly, over here, not many people want to live in places like Botswana, Namibia, or the Northern Cape, because it's not well enough watered. And again, you can see the vast amount of black people in South Africa coalesced over the Kingdom of Zululand and Transkei. It just makes sense. That's where they want to be, and that's where the best rainfall was. So again, you can get demographics from the population maps. The white settlers of the Cape first came face to face with the Bantu, with the black people, around 1770 on the banks of the Great Fish River, which was 120 years after Jan van Riebeeck settled in the Cape and 1,000 kilometers east of Cape Town. It's a long way away. Whites created, this is the fourth lie, whites created black reserves and homelands. Blacks created homelands themselves, actually, thanks to Shaka Zulu, the founder of the Kingdom of Zululand. The common belief is that the black tribes at that time were all living peacefully in the spirit of Ubuntu, which is, I'm told by my Zulu friends, the word for humanism. So when you hear Christians speaking about Ubuntu, well, no, it's not, they try to put a nice spin on it, but actually it's the same word in Zulu for what we would use humanism for today.
I am because we are.
Uh-huh. Man-centeredness. So in the spirit of Ubuntu, everyone is living in a virtual liberal paradise. But nothing could be further from the truth. Shaka Zulu was a genocidal ruler who wiped out multitudes of black people in the Difukan, or the Mifukan, the Great Crushing. The Zulu tyrant, Shaka, at the time was committing genocide against other tribes, literally wiping them out. The Swazis and the Indibelis fled back north in the direction of Central Africa, where they'd migrated from. You can see the knock-on effect. And basically, 156 tribes were exterminated or were amalgamated in the Mifukan. In a region of 3 million people died just between about 1816 and 1830, basically. In that time period, you had about 3 million people killed and about 156 tribes wiped out. And the Zulu Kingdom was the originator of it, but the knock-on effect was just staggering. One tribe after another, after another, after another. The Sotus fled into the mountains of what today is Lesotho, up the high places, rocks and caves. The rest of the small tribes huddled together trying to find strength and coalescing. And this is one of the pictures of the people fleeing the burnings and destruction of the villages and taking what little, pitiful little they could carry and fleeing to the highlands. And so the way the British saw it at that time was they were coming with civilization to protect the black tribes who were fleeing to them for protection from the armies of barbarism. I mean, this is a very politically incorrect picture today, but that was the way that the British Times of London portrayed it in a very grandiose, heroic, triumphal way. That is part of the history of black South Africa that many prefer to ignore, that blacks drove other blacks off their land, not whites. It was into this maelstrom of black chaos that the Boers trekked in 1838. Many people forget that the Zulus went as far as Katima Malelu. Katima Malelu is a Zulu term, up in on the Zambezi, in the Caprivi. They went as far as Malawi. In fact, Lake Nyasa, you still have Zulus living there. I've met Zulus in Zambia. So some Zulu tribes never stopped. They just kept going. And in fact, it was broadcast around the world at one time that Dr. Livingstone had been killed by Zulus on the banks of the Lake Nyasa, Lake Malawi. So the Mifikon was colossal. As far as they went, they found large open sections of country uninhabited by anyone. Black survivors fleeing Shaka's carnage grouped themselves into areas near whites to secure protection from the Zulu and the Matabele. And so this is why many black people came to be close to towns where whites were, because that's where they sought protection. And many of the tribes made agreements with the trekkers in order to protect them from the Zulu and the Matabele. This is how Sir Theophilus Shepson later found the remnants of black refugees huddled together on self-created reserves. And he just demarcated these areas to protect them from each other. And so it wasn't that the whites suddenly said, all you Zulus are going to have to go and live in a place we're going to call Zululand. And you, Khoza, we're going to ship you away from Cape Town over to Transkei. No, that's where they were. It wasn't a matter of forcing them there. That was their homelands. And their homelands were protected against white criminal elements who'd want to come in and extort money from them. And Asians in particular had come and hire purchase and so on. The creators of the Bantustans, or homelands as they were called, were not the Boers or the whites. It was black men like Shaka, Mzilikazi, and Dingaan. They created the homelands. It was their wars that led to the actual coalition of nations as they are today. There wouldn't be a Lesotho. There wouldn't be a Swaziland if it hadn't been for the Mifikon, Difikon, where they had to flee to mountainous areas where they could protect themselves. And so you can learn about the warrior chiefs of Southern Africa, books written by people like Ian Knight. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. There's all kinds of talk of liberty, but behind it all is communism, and they're only using this narrative in order to get people to do their will. They don't care about the actual issue. You can lead a man to knowledge, but you cannot make him think. People have to do their own thinking about this. Truth is now being called hate speech, because during a time of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act. Just take this one example here. Paardeberg. This is what it used to look like in the evil days of apartheid. This is what it looks like today. Same place. It's not about land. It's about what you do with the land. Have I now become your enemy because I've told you the truth? The Apostle Paul said in Galatians 4:16. This is where we live, right here, at that point. And we live in a mostly waterless, desolate, rain-scarce region. But a great civilization has been built here. And on other times, I've shown a whole lot of pictures from Lady Anne Barnard depicting what the Cape was like 240 years ago. Arid. There were no trees. They couldn't keep 20,000 people alive in front of Table Mountain because there wasn't enough water. But the evil colonials planted millions of trees in the Cape Peninsula and made this arid thornbush territory literally flow. All these trees were planted by the Dutch and the British because there were no trees in Cape Town. The only place a sailor could find trees to chop down to repair his ship was Hout Bay. Hout Bay called Hout Bay because that was where the wood was. The next forest was Knysna. All the forests between Knysna and Hout Bay were planted by the settlers, which are now being ripped up. And we know this because of people like Lady Anne Barnard, who painstakingly documented with 400 pictures too, watercolors and the rest. This settlement here is just an extraordinary testament to a very vibrant Christian civilization that has come and settled and built for future generations and built well. And that this be abused by people of a slash and burn and loot mentality with Marxism. No, under no circumstances. Truth does not fear investigation. Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? I like this logo, smash cultural Marxism. It's a lot of idols built on lies. So, any questions, any comments?
I remember reading the Zulu history, and Mizlakazi, when the general of the Zulus, who fled with troops from Shaka Zulu, I mean, he exterminated everything in the Transvaal on his way to Rhodesia.
Yeah.
You know, so when the Boers actually came there, there was nothing but the Tsetse fly. There was no living human being in the Transvaal. They killed everything.
It was desolate.
They destroyed every single tribe, or assimilated the women and children into their tribes, and they completely destroyed all life there. You know?
In fact, Mzilikazi probably killed more people than Shaka and Dingaan combined, which is saying a lot. So the Matabele, who were Zulus, but they broke away from them, Shaka wiped out everything near him. But Mzilikazi took it on a roadshow, like a felt fire, straight through what today is the Northern Free State, through the Transvaal. Devastation. And that's why these scattered survivors were pleading with the Boers, settle here, protect us, look after us, so on. Yes, who was it who wrote those?
Peter Becker.
Peter Becker wrote a lot of great books on Mzilikazi, Dingaan, Shaka. Oh, yes. I mean, I grew up reading those books. I knew the Matabele and the Zulu, I knew their stories better than many of our own, because they're the people I grew up amongst in Rhodesia. And unfortunately, today, most people don't even know these stories.
The truth is that if the British and Boers had not confronted the Zulus, there would be no other tribes. Every springtime, the Zulu extended their kingdom 200 kilometers, you know, and then left dead bodies. You had to get into the Zulu kingdom, you had to come through 200 kilometers, they said, of
scorched earth,
watching people's rib cages blowing in the wind, death. You rode through death. And then every spring, the Zulu would extend the kingdom another 200 and leave another 200 cases. So to get to the kingdom, you had to go through just dead bodies and people lying all over the place. You know, they would have wiped out everything. And the Khoza and that were fleeing from the Zulus, you know, that were extending their kingdom, they couldn't stop them. So there wouldn't have been left anything in Africa. And they would have just taken the whole of South Africa.
If they'd got as far as the Cape, there wouldn't be Bushmen.
No, they're on their way.
Khoi either.
Mm-hmm. So that's crazy.
And the element that most people are missing out of most of this too is providential view of history. God intervenes in the course of human events. If world history had been left up to human beings, the Mongolians, the Huns, the Attila the Hun, Mongol invasions, they were wiping out just about everyone across the whole of Northern Hemisphere. And it's God's intervention that has saved man from man's depravity. And again, you can see the hand of God that brought God-fearing Boers into the Cape, who came not with an intention of just exploiting the territory. And I'm afraid a lot of that was done in North America and Australia. But they mustn't project their efforts onto us. I must say, from in the past, I used to think white South Africans must be the most racist people in the world. And I've come to the conclusion that white South Africans have probably done more to help black people than all others combined. And it's an amazing thing. I think we've got some of the least racist people on the planet when you see of what's been done. And practically speaking, some of the worst racists on the planet are probably people like Robert Mugabe and Julius Malema. But in their narrative, they are the victims and everyone else are the villains. But as a Christian, we must always be self-critical. We've got to look at ourselves and say, what do we need to change? And so the Christians who came here, you think of how, and you can see it right from the beginning, from the first prayer of Jan van Riebeek, praying that this outpost would be for the spread of the gospel throughout Africa. I mean, and he was right from the beginning concerned for relationships with indigenous people and developing contracts and treaties with the Khoi and the San and observing their cultures and how they did things and what gifts would bless them. And so you had a very different mentality of those who came with a rapacious mentality, you know, those unsaved, unregenerate characters came and we want the gold. And you could see that happened often. Spanish arrived in South America and they want the gold. And the only thing that matters is the gold. And they massacred their way across Peru or whatever to get the Inca gold. And that mentality, you don't see that here. It didn't happen in the Cape because there was a Reformation and the people who came here had been influenced by the gospel. Not to say they were all born again, but there was enough influence of the gospel that they understood you must be a good neighbor and to be thoughtful. And there's a difference where a secular humanist comes along and looks down another person thinking, you're not as evolved as me. And they because of their secular humanism, evolutionism, they devalued human life. Whereas a reformed Christian understands the depravity of man, understood the wickedness in his own heart that needs to be restrained by God's laws, and looked at people, even primitive people, as souls for whom Christ died. So you can see such a difference in the mentality and what they've done around the world, maybe from their own guilt, but Australians, Canadians, and North Americans have projected their guilt of how they treated the Aborigines and Indians onto us and assumed we did the same. There's proof that we did not. You take the population. We have taken the population, the original population of all the Xhosa back in 1850s when they did the national suicide. There were about 100,000 Xhosa. Today they're what, 7-8 million? That's no way to run a genocide. The Zulu were a very small kingdom at one point. I think there were barely 200,000 at the time of Dingaan, not even that. And in fact, in days of Keshwe, I think it numbered around 200,000. And today, 7-8 million, maybe 9 million by now. With Aborigines in Australia are less than they were when the Australians arrived. The Indians in North America are much less than they were when the Canadians and Americans arrived. So they did a different thing. We didn't decrease the population. In fact, the population of black people in South Africa so increased that we got outnumbered known countries, became a minority-known country. And it's to such an extent that at this moment, most of the black people in South Africa weren't born in South Africa. And it was always so. There was more and more coming in from all over, walking from Malawi to work on the mines. Because even under the worst days of apartheid, and there were excesses surely by small-minded bureaucrats, South Africa was still a better country for any black person to live in than any free black country around Africa. And people knew that coming, whether it was from Congo or Mozambique, they knew they would find a better place here in apartheid South Africa than they could find in free Mozambique. That tells you something. And so this endless hatred against white South Africans, suggesting that these are the most evil, selfish, racist people on the planet, when actually nobody's done more to help black people and raise their standard of living and propel them into the 20th and 21st century than South Africa. Other people may talk about caring for Africa, but nobody's done more for Africa than the South Africans. That's true for missions as well. So I've always believed in supporting the underdog. And so in Rhodesia, I would have been quickly getting into fights with others, including my own brother, standing up for the Matabele. But these days, who's the underdog? White South Africans. And so, you know, I've moved to the point where I'm finding myself actually having to stand up for my own people because we are now so maligned that many people think that it's not a crime to murder and torture to death white South Africans. It's just gotten that bad. And so somebody's got to tell the truth and say, but these are the facts. We didn't find the people living in freedom and peace and tranquility and steal anything from them. We found people living in savage, primitive, witchcraft obsession, absolutely oppressed with none of the essentials of life, and lifted them up and gave them literacy and gave them the gospel and trebled their life expectancy. And how on earth can you be called a racist for that? And multiplied the population. So I think I saw something a while ago that, is it that the population of the blacks in South Africa have increased times 99 since the whites came here. So nobody can actually sensibly accuse the whites of trying to wipe them out. If anything, what we've done is endanger our own future by doing such a brilliant job of increasing their life expectancy that now we're outnumbered and we're a minority in our own country. Even in the Western Cape, we can't even find our own people to serve us if we're in hospital or if we go to vote, because they're projecting a nationwide demographic of saying there's got to be 80% black people for every job, even though that's not the demographic in the Western Cape. And they're pushing out the colored people. They're not letting indigenous Cape Townians get jobs. And you can see this the clearest when you've got an election like the IEC. It's all done by them because they're trying to colonize the Cape. But unlike the original colonists, they're not trying to build anything up and bring new services. They're trying to steal and take everything away and kill the local inhabitants. So it has to be said, the entire political edifice of the ANC is built on lies. I've just tackled four of them tonight. So, any other comments?
I had another one of those, I think, lies last night when we were counting, observing counting the votes. There was but he said the ANC, 50 of them are now being trained, two of them are at every station, also monitoring. And some of the things that they learned is that the Bantu education system is what it was called, like, kept all of them, they were only taught how to clean and how to be gardeners. And they were oppressed, and because my ancestors are richer, I have a better
opportunities.
And so somehow they need to get more. And
that's a definite, total, complete lie. Mm-hmm. First of all, even the people in the education department themselves have had to admit that the apartheid education was better than what they're offering now. Even people like Desmond Tutu said it was better under apartheid than now. The education system we've got now is such a failure. Now, how can they say they were never taught anything more than how to clean and so on? Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki got their law degrees studying in apartheid universities. In fact, Mandela, when he became president, went to Muizenberg to Cecil Rhodes's cottage, where Cecil Rhodes died. And he made a statement, and in fact, he's also made the same speech at Rhodes University and others. All my education is thanks to this man, Cecil John Rhodes. His money, the Rhodes Trust, paid for the mission school that I got my primary education in Transkei, the high school and the university, which was the old Presbyterian University Forte. So, and he said it was Cecil Rhodes's money and trust, which provided for all levels of my education, primary, secondary, and tertiary. That's Nelson Mandela said that. I wouldn't have known it if he hadn't said that. There's a whole range of people out there who got their education in South Africa. Do you know that people like Robert Mugabe came to South Africa to Forte University for his education in law? He was recruited into the Southern Communist Party by communist South African Jews at the university, went back a communist and started his revolutionary nonsense in Rhodesia, but he got his education at Fort Hare University. All over South Africa, people have come from all over the world because the education offered to black people in South Africa was superior to that they could get anywhere else, and that was under apartheid. Hendrik Verwoerd quadrupled the literacy of black people in this country in his short prime ministership. He was seen sitting in the garden with his gardener on Saturdays, teaching his gardener to read and write. He was Minister of Native Affairs before he became Prime Minister, and Hendrik Verwoerd was passionate about giving literacy to everyone. And that they've slandered that man to suggest that he wanted them to have a low level of education is nonsense. He increased the level of education. He was spending 8 times more on black education than on white education, and the whites were the only ones paying the taxes. And in fact, his own people were criticizing him because he's doing so much for the black people. And today they talk like Hendrik Verwoerd was the most evil man who just want to oppress the black people. But he's the one who was preparing for them to get independence for trans guys, cis guys. He is giving them their own independence. What people had to fight for in Croatia, Slovenia, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, he was giving them free. Like, you want freedom? You want to rule yourself? We will help you. He was forcing companies to build factories in the homelands or just on the boundaries of the homelands because they weren't allowed to actually own land in the homelands if they were white companies like Anglo American, for example, to provide more jobs for the people. So there was very forward-thinking strategies where they were trying to have decentralization, not overcrowding, and which often leads to crime and breakup of families. So he saw the need to send the factories to where the people were, things like that. But for anybody to come out with and say that South Africa deliberately tried to keep the education of black people down, that's not only not fair. Take the Rhodesians. In Rhodesia, the Rhodesian black people at the highest level of literacy, and still do in all of Africa, and the highest level of education in all of Africa, and it's at the lowest unemployment in all of Africa. Rhodesia was second only to South Africa in its agricultural strength, but in education, Rhodesia even exceeded South Africa only just on the literacy level with black people. And why is it that white countries, which did more than any black country did for their own people, get criticized that they were trying to keep them down? Only whites paid the income tax, and the blacks got all the benefits. So that if I was a black man, I would have gotten free education. But because I was white, I had to pay for my education. I had to work my way through theological college. I never got free education there because I was too male and too pale under apartheid. 1980s, early 80s, I got no grants whatsoever for my study. But I ended debt-free because I worked a six-day a week, 8 hours a night job to put myself through college. And then I want to talk about white privilege. The white privilege our generation had was getting caned at school and getting conscripted in the army and rock PT and all the rest of it, getting people shout at you, shoot at you, and all the rest. And that's our white privilege. So I think what these people are doing, they're either not honest or they're not well-informed or they've been brainwashed because...
She totally believed what she said.
You know, that might have happened in Australia or United States. It might have. I don't know that it always did because there's a lot of exaggerations there too. But there were times where they would want to keep the people down there. But over here, that wasn't the attitude of Christians. And that's why the farmers, you take the first great mission from South Africa. I'm not talking about Knodendal now, the Moravians, but Andrew Murray starts the South Africa General Mission. The first mission is up in the Magaliesberg. Paul Kruger gives his territory of his farm for the missionaries from the Cape to settle there to go and reach out to the Tswana people and to establish a mission amongst the Tswana. Now, if Paul Kruger didn't care about the Tswana, why would he have done that? And if Andrew Murray didn't care about them, why did he send missionaries there? And the first missionaries to Tswana died within a few months of arriving of disease. And more missionaries came and took their place. When you've got the graves of missionaries planted all over Africa, why would they have gone there and done this if they didn't love the people? It's just so wicked that there's these lies. And I've been hearing these lies as long as I've been a Christian. And that's what led me to still my favorite book of all the books I've written is Greatest Century of Missions. And I wrote it because I was sick and tired of the slander against missionaries that I heard in every mission conference from idiots who thought that they could do better than David Livingstone. And just think they don't understand what they were facing. They don't understand what they sacrificed. They don't understand what they achieved. And so going all over Africa and seeing the graves of missionaries outside churches, and you realize the price that was paid to bring the gospel to Africa, how dare anyone besmirch the memory of these wonderful Christians who sacrificed so much for them. So that's what started me onto the history battle, because I see that's part of the battle. You cannot fight this battle if you don't understand the history. The history is what the communists are always trying to twist. So if we want to counter them, we've got to know our own history better. So, any other comments, questions? Yes.
Just getting back to the Emma? Martin Reed
Yes.
Conference.
How many of the gents here have been there? Have any of you been to Martin and
to the conference?
No,
I've been to one of those popular lessons.
So, and then you said that's a perfect ideal opportunity to bring forth that we mustn't vote for XYZ or the men. Has it ever been brought forth in the album? How many people?
I'm convinced not, because you just take one Mighty Men's conference had 250,000 people. We had less than that number of voters voting for pro-life parties in the country.
Yes.
There was one Mighty Men's conference that was actually over at election time, that the people were not even in the areas that they could vote.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
But was that discussed at the Mighty Men by them? Or was it just
Dave was at a lot of them.
I've never heard of it. Never heard
they never told the guys what to do. This is what he said. There's too many prayer meetings. And we're all for prayer meetings, but there's no leadership. There's no one standing up and saying 3 million people go and vote for Christian. But I mean, the DA's got just almost 2 million now.
Most of those are probably Christians voting for.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. So
but
if we could get 3 million,
if the Mighty Men walked out of there and they were going back to their
families,
to their work,
it's times three.
Then that goes out.
And that's not even considering their wives and daughters, which would exponentially increase.
Yeah, but then your word of mouth would at home, from home, go to
bring
school,
hands
from work to the rest of the churches that haven't been. Why, after all these years, has it not been done? And now
the
election is gone.
Yeah, they don't want to offend the people in the audience. And men of God have got to get over that. You are going to offend people. You know, you've got to take a stand for God and righteousness. You are going to be hated.
Mm.
You know, and we've got no leaders anymore. Nobody's actually taking us and saying, do this. It's like everyone's too scared. You know, it's terrible. You know, we're in a terrible situation like that.
Sometimes it's cowardice. Sometimes it's confusion. Many times people might believe it as Lishka says. I mean, you've got some people who really believe these things. And to think that you've got people literally committing economic, cultural, demographic suicide in many cases. And now you've got these whiteys running around wearing red berets and EFF t-shirts. How insane is that? That you've got people who actually support those who want to kill them. It's called the Stockholm Syndrome. Stockholm Syndrome is from a term from kidnappers, that when a person is at the mercy of a kidnapper, an abusive person, they sometimes identify fully with them because they want to believe the best of them because their life depends on them. And so you've had people who've been kidnapped ending up actually fighting against the rescuers and defending the people who've been abusing them. You see this also in abusive marriages. Frequently you'll see a woman who's a codependent. She's abused by a nasty, drunkard, beating husband, say, and if anyone asks, no, I walked into a lamp pole, I fell down the stairs, I walked into the wall, and so on. It's never her husband's fault. She feels she's to blame. He makes her feel that she's to blame. And so you get that sort of thing where now you've got a bunch of white South Africans who's stolen from, lied about, hated, and in many cases their friends and relatives murdered and tortured and so on. And they make excuses for the ANC, and actually it's our fault. And it's the same thing at Stockholm Syndrome. We've got a bunch of them. And Charlize Theron, classic example. She could have adopted one of these white children orphaned on a farm attack whose parents have been tortured by these ANC-type thugs. But no. She's got to adopt some poor black kid and then call this boy a girl, which is child abuse. And sends money to support Julius Malema's EFF. She could be a voice for South Africans overseas. She's got an international voice. And instead, she uses it to support the very people who are oppressing the people. And this is somebody who comes from Benoni. And
that's because she knows she's no longer in the problem.
Well, I don't know. I think she's been brainwashed to such an extent. She's got Stockholm Syndrome too. She identifies with the enemy. And the ones who want to kill you—that—that is—it's a psychological situation that's been documented, where victims and abused people identify with their abusers.
The other thing is also with what we discussed earlier is the BEE. You know, people cling to their jobs and they will say what they get paid to say. And meaning pay to say is not you tell them to say that. It means that that's their pay to get home. So they won't stand up against certain things because they are earning a living for their families.
Hmm.
Well, so very yeah. often that could be, and that could be her income generating, not saying not brainwashed, but the more she says that, the more support she'll get from the Americans, who's worse than us South Africans ever. Yes. With racism, but and that well, she'll get more support there by being with them. If
we had broken as many treaties with black people as the Americans did with the Indians, if we had treated the local black people in this country like the Americans treat the Indians, we had a totally different story. I'm not saying the Americans were always on the wrong side. Their government was treacherous. And even many American military people, even General Custer himself, admitted that the U.S. government's Indian policy was insane and that they were goading the Indians to the point where the Indians would retaliate. And even though they'd have no chance of victory, but they would fight just out of frustration because Custer even complained about how they, time and again, after giving them this reserve, signed into perpetuity or something, next thing handed over to the miners, and, it just kept moving them off the land. And the seventh cavalry had to do the dirty job, and he was protesting about it. He ended up a victim of the very policy he warned him about. So the trouble is, I think some Americans see that story, and instead of acknowledging their guilt, they project it on South Africans and assume, oh, you must be doing the same thing. We didn't. It's just so wicked, though, that and you know, to get to Australia and get the Australians trying to lecture us about race relations. The Australians hunted Aborigines for sport.
Yes.
Abo hunting. And they want to accuse us of being racists. They decreased the Aboriginal population down to a fraction. We've exploded the population of Indigenous people. How on earth is that comparable? We bought hospital. I mean, you just look what the Boers did for the zoo. Staggering.
I'm just thinking the lady that she was talking about just now is that if they can be brainwashed at a Māori men's conference, for example, the people can be whitewashed at getting the message.
Not that we're suggesting everyone's been brainwashed at a Māori men's conference.
They should be exposed to that harsh, not harsh words, but the reality.
And, you know,
for us,
Angus Buchan showed courage to tackle other issues well. One wonders why he doesn't want to go anywhere near the socio-political, but there's more than that, because there's a lot of other issues. Right now, you know,
is
that there's...
Is it a threat of anything?
There's this Australian rugby player who's been...
Israel.
Correct. Because he's made a statement that the politically correct pervert crowd don't like. And he's been lifted up now as a good example. And insofar as he's made that stand, good for him and so on. But his whole body seems full of tattoos. And the amount of people who are sharing his pictures, even, you know, the... in such a way that you could just see tattoos all over the place, as an example of a perfect, wonderful Christian model, I'm thinking this is problematic. Yes, he's been brave in his point, but every picture of him seems to promote a body modification, tattooing lifestyle. Is that the message we want to send to young people? This is a model of someone who's to follow. No, I would say the last thing, if I had to show his picture, I would... be warning against tattoos too. I wouldn't want to give the impression that by silence I'm endorsing that. God hates tattoos. There's so many scriptures against it. It's part of the whole culture of rebellion against God. If our bodies are living sacrifice to God, we don't have the right to just deface it like that. And this man's obviously got some part of the truth and he's shown some courage. But he's not a model I'd lift up to any of our young people. And there's something radically wrong on so many levels. We've got people being converted who not, well, convert's the wrong word. We have people who are accepting Jesus who are not getting truly converted and regenerate. You don't see transformed lives. It's so much clearer when you get a person who was a gangster and now he's converted and he's on fire for Christ. A person who was a drunkard, now he's sober. A person who was a thief who does restitution. Think like George Bush. Stole all those diamonds from the diamond mines, got away with it, nobody suspected a thing, then he's converted,
he does full restitution. And then you know he's saved. He's burned his bridges. He's decided to follow Jesus, no turning back. And that's the kind of conversion that changes a person's life. I was brought up in a secular family. First time I heard the gospel, I went forward and surrendered my life to Christ, and nothing's been the same since. For converts, it's easier. But now we've got a whole generation of people being told, you don't have to be that radical. You just need to just pray this prayer, just raise your hand. Nobody's looking. It's easy to be a Christian. Just believe. Just pray this prayer. And then somewhere down the line, he starts hearing things like full surrender and sacrifice and be filled with the Spirit. And as Anthony is saying, they start saying, well, what? I didn't read that small print, you know. I didn't sign up for that. I accepted, come to Jesus and he'll improve your business and make you happy and prosperous, healthy and wealthy. So we're going the wrong direction when you're encouraging people to basically just accept Jesus. And what did Rick Warren say? Try him. 40-day money-back guarantee. Try Jesus.
It's also been said, put him on like a jacket for a while.
Well, I just get martyred in this, what he does.
It's just such an insult. I mean, God isn't interested in being tried out, you know.
It's not a pair of shoes.
No, it's... So, but just think, young people surely want a challenge. You encourage people to climb the highest mountain, run the fastest mile, whatever it is, a challenge. And then along comes a church and not even providing a challenge of give up your small ambitions and follow Jesus, take up your cross and follow Christ, deny the world and the flesh, follow in Christ's footsteps, something biblical like that. Instead, it's this weak, wimpy, mealy-mouthed, purpose-driven Willow Creek type of prayer of Jabez, saddleback. It's just so wimpy, weedy, and wet. It's anemic. It's gutless. It's spineless. It's nauseating. It's lukewarm. No wonder the Lord says he wants to vomit them out, because that's not Christianity. The Lord gave everything for us. He expects us to give everything for him. How can we go settle for anything else? We don't want some kind of, you know, well, I'll try Jesus, and he's got to grow my business and give me this and... This isn't a business transaction. I mean, it's not like used car salesmen. We're meant to be ambassadors for the King. And I don't see what's wrong with stand up, surrender your life to Christ, make a stand in front of everyone while every eye is open, every head is bowed. Why should we be ashamed of making a stand for Christ? This whole idea of, you know, while every eye is closed, it's just, it's starting on the wrong foot. Why should people be embarrassed about making a stand for the Lord? He wasn't executed in secret. He suffered in shameful way in public, a criminal's death. How can I not be willing to suffer some inconvenience and have people unfriending me on Facebook? Taking up your cross. This person unfriended me.